Christmas blue light goes on.
Like, see a picture of me?
Have to
go outside.
Good morning.
I didn't see that.
This is the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means, and it is the middle of June, the 15th, as we work rapidly toward sine die in about 3.5 weeks. Today, we're going to hold a work session on Senate Bill 932. We had individuals that wanted to testify, but we have been told by staff that they didn't give a 24-hour notice.
The co-chairs have.
Co-chairs have not given a 24-hour notice for public testimony, so all we're going to be able to do is work session. So if anybody wanted to submit public testimony, you can do that in writing and get it to Representative Comp and myself, and also to Chairs Buckley and Devlin. And we'll go from there. So, staff?
Okay. I don't know if we have enough members to do the work session first.
Yes, we do. We got three and two.
Okay. So, we'll start. Do you want to open a...
I will open a work session on Senate Bill 932.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 932 relates to the cost of attending public universities. The measure previously had a public hearing and work session in the Senate Education Committee and was recommended as due pass with amendments and referred to Ways and Means. The measure has an A2 amendment, which is posted on OLIS. It's the LFO recommended amendment, which provides $43,499 general fund appropriation for a 0.08 FTE funding. And that is what I have.
Okay, thanks, Krista. Appreciate it. Questions of staff? Madam Co-Chair, an amendment on the A2, a motion on the A2 amendment.
Mr. Co-Chair, I move the dash A2 amendment to Senate Bill 932.
Okay, are there any questions on the motion? Is there any objection to the motion? A2 is adopted. Madam Co-Chair.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair. I move Senate Bill 932 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Questions? Any objections? Representative Springer objects. Any other objections? Okay, now we need carriers. Madam Co-Chair.
I will carry this in the House floor. And is Senator Roblin, whose bill is this? Do you know, Senator?
It's yours.
Oh, okay.
You're one of the people, along with Dembro, Courtney, Vega Peterson.
Okay.
Madam Co-Chair,
it's Monday morning.
I know.
Madam Co-Chair, to full Ways and Means and
yes.
To the House floor.
Yes.
And Senator Roblin
sure.
To the Senate floor.
Sounds great.
Okay, that's done. Close the work session on 932. And Krista, where are we?
Okay, up next is House Bill 2955, and we're going to do a public hearing on that one. You want the summary of the bill first before we open public hearing?
Sure.
Okay, House Bill 2955 comes to you from the House Committee on Education. The bill has a $200,000 fiscal impact. The bill directs the Oregon Department of Education to administer a process for providing funding for activities relating to an annual conference dedicated to Oregon Civics and held on Oregon Civics Day for teachers.
And being a retired civics teacher, I think this is a very appropriate measure, and we will open a public hearing on 2955. And do we have somebody that wants to testify? Here we go. Where shall I start? Classroom Law Project, mm-hmm. Barbara Roost.
Yep.
Okay, Barbara, come on up. And anybody else from the Law Project? Oh, we'll just start with Barbara. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Co-Chair. I wonder if it's appropriate if I brought a teacher and two students with
Bring
me.
Bring them up.
Come on down.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you'll have to pull up a chair. Or two.
Thank you very much for the allowance of this. With me is Drew Monarchy, teacher from West Salem nearby, and two students who formerly were eighth graders at West Sylvan, but now they're going to be high school students. And I'll let them introduce themselves, but they have a little bit to say about how they think you might want to view this bill, 2955. Drew?
Good morning. I'm Drew Monarchy from West Salem High School. It's an honor to be here, co-chairs and committees of the chair. A couple words for you. For you educators here, in an era of math, science, language arts, social studies is unfortunately the culprit and the victim in budget cuts and time to have to be sacrificed. The cost is, at times, a less civic-minded student and ultimately maybe a less civic-minded citizen of our state. Allowing, and in the state of Oregon, that cost is very unique. With the initiative process, which allows citizens to become lawmakers and a well-informed voters, crucial to our democratic success. This is where House Bill 2955 would come into play. It would extend funding to teachers to every legislative district so they can attend a statewide civics conference and receive follow-up classroom support. And that's what I really want to hit on just briefly. I've been to many a professional development where it hasn't benefited me. And I got some smiles already, and I love that. Absolutely love it. You know the professional development that can be immediately put into the classroom. You appreciate the strategies that can be put away right there. And maybe even not at that professional development, it's that teacher that inspired you that says, okay, I can go and do this. That's what this organization provides, bar none. And it's not just that professional development for 180 teachers. That's the cost that you're buying. Mm-hmm. It is, they're committed to follow-up support. Now, I've never really truly had that at a professional development. I may have seen a wonderful teacher do it at a conference, but putting it into a classroom, it bombs. How neat and what a wonderful opportunity it is to have the resources to back me up later on. I'll end with this, and that's where these two will come in. I've been in education for 16 years. I'm one teacher, but I've already taught over 2,000 students. And if you're willing to invest in 180 teachers, look what you're investing in, thousands of students. And two of them are right here for you. Thank you, guys.
Yeah, and thank you for your testimony. Barbara, I don't think we got your name on the record.
It's Barbara Rost, R-O-S-T. Program manager or program director at Classroom Law Project.
Thank you very much. And of course, I taught advanced history and government for 21 years at the high school level, and then I taught at the college level after that. So I appreciate what you're saying. And ladies, give us your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Sophia Tackla, and with me is Madeline Gochi.
Hello.
Good afternoon, co-chairs Comp and Monroe and members of the committee.
And it's still morning.
Whoops, that's true, okay. We've been up since 6, so it feels like afternoon.
That's okay.
So, we will be ninth graders at Lincoln High School in the fall. The past 2 years, we've had the wonderful opportunity of being educated by Karen Rouse, who could not be here today. Having a teacher heavily focused on civics and one educated by the Classroom Law Project, we have become passionate about this cause. We are here today in support of House Bill 2955.
Sophie and I have been the students of Ms. Rouse since 7th grade. In that time, we've spent more time learning about civics, government, and politics than our peers in other classes. We have done many extra units and activities, including a unit on the 2014 election and what it means to be an informed voter. We have put on a mock trial and experienced a unit on the forms of government and its roles and our responsibilities in our democracy. Sophia and I were in a congressional hearings unit together where we delved into federalism and judicial review. We have learned more concepts such as our natural rights, civic virtue, separation of powers, and how a bill becomes a law and the common good. We've also been studying the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence from our We the People textbooks. While other classes in our school have access to this valuable resource, there are schools and students in Oregon who are not as lucky. Sophia and I are fortunate to have a teacher who is thoroughly educated on how to teach students civics and how civics are significant. Sophia and I, as well as our block class, had the opportunity to visit the Capitol building, an experience that would not have been possible without Ms. Rouse's attendance in the December teacher conference funded by this bill. Ms. Rouse has been very motivated to set up a meeting with Representative Bonamici, an inspiring opportunity. We've also had a mock legislative hearing where we discussed the 2014 elections in front of senators and representatives just like you. She encouraged my recent service as an honorary page under my local representative, Mitch Greenlick. And I know I never would have found such an opportunity without the excitement and passion Ms. Rouse has given me in regards to civics and our local government. I also want to recognize Sophia and I's good friend, Jessica Motley. She's a former student of Ms. Rouse as well, and she and I testified on behalf of this bill on the Committee of Education. She was disappointed she could not make it here today, but her thoughts are with us in this bill.
Yes, we are very sad to be missing Jessica, but I am glad to be here today. Just like Madeline said, the past 2 years have been informative and enriching as Ms. Rouse prepared us to become the responsible citizens that we will need to be one day. I can speak for both of us when I say that we have also had a lot of fun during this experience. I'm proud to say that I understand civics and politics now better than my parents do, and it wouldn't have been without this fabulous opportunity. While Ms. Rouse may no longer be our teacher, we are ecstatic to pursue civics activities in high school. Madeline and I are both interested in Constitution Team and have even plotted our campaigns for student government next year. Ever since this year, I love sitting down and talking about current events with my family and debating our opinions. We all share our research, and I love to help them vote. Ms. Rouse had shed new light on what it really means to become an informed voter. Trust me when I say I'll be registering the day of my 18th birthday. Wait, I guess that I won't have to because of Governor Brown's new law automatically registering everyone with a driver's license to vote. But this isn't about my future and the future of others. When we become eligible to vote, we will have a choice about candidates and ballot measures that will not only affect our futures, but those of the people who can't vote. It is because of this that we need to become educated voters, knowing where to find valid information and how to decipher biased campaigns and negative political advertising. What better to learn this than at a resilient young age when we are still forming our opinions? Who knows? Maybe Madeline or I will be sitting where you are in the future. We are the next generation. I ask you to think back to when you were our age and what it would have been like to get such a head start into the world of government and politics. Maybe we would have had higher voter registration and participation. Maybe all Americans would care as much as you and I do about the future of Oregon and the people in it. Don't you think that we should put resources into educating my generation, future generations, so that we can follow in your footsteps and become great leaders, politicians, and informed voters? HB 2955 benefits our public schools, public educators, Oregon's youth, and our government and federal system. When asked what kind of government America was made, Benjamin Franklin once said, "A republic, if you can keep it."
How else will citizens be able to keep our republic unless they know what we are protecting? With the funding of House Bill 2955, we will be able to create an educated future for Oregon and the United States. Thank you for your time. We'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, ladies. Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Monroe. Actually, I do have a question. Do you consider yourselves Democrats or Republicans, young ladies?
Well,
not that it will influence anything in our voting, but
co-chairs and members of the committee, I actually think that that isn't necessarily super important to government, because I feel that we need to focus on the common good and our natural rights rather than what party then we fall into. I kind of fall in between, to be honest. I don't know. I agree with both and disagree with both. I kind of don't find myself, I don't know. I'm not really sure. I kind of focus on Oregon as a whole rather than just a party.
Thank you.
She won that
round. Well done.
Witness one, Taylor none.
He's going for a solid vote across the committee, I think. That's good.
Are there other questions for the witnesses? Senator Roblin.
Not a question, just a comment. Thank you both for being here and imparting your wisdom on some of us. As a math teacher who taught a group for youth and government, I have always believed that. So before you got into this class and you had social studies, were you excited about it?
Co-chairs and Senator Roblin, to be honest, I didn't really know a lot about government. Before I was a sixth grader, I went to Ms. Ross's seventh grader. I pretty much just knew who the president was. That was about it. But now after this year, I've definitely learned so much more about government and so much more about politics that I'm so interested in pursuing other things next year with the Constitution team and Model UN and all that. And I know that that wouldn't have been possible without Ms. Rouse and without her knowledge of all the civics that had happened.
Sounds like they're off to a good start. Go ahead.
Well, I used to come, you know, I was a math person, so I taught a foreign language to most people. And so it was always interesting to me because we had a few teachers who got really excited about government and got kids involved in local government. And those people I knew were going to go get voters. And I said that to my other socialized teachers, you know, we've gotten more and more into teaching socialized in a formal kind of way, where here's the book, here's the materials, you're going to know about government, and so on. And I said, I think there's a direct correspondence between people involved in voting in government, an inverse relationship. So the more we've gotten, made it more and more of an academic class, the fewer and fewer vote. You know, the academic thing seems to make people cynical voters, and so they choose not to vote because they bring up all the history and all the cynical things. And the people who get engaged in understanding it want to be a part of the future. So I'm excited to hear about this. I believe in this program and the way it does things with respect to getting key people engaged, because I always felt that in public education, our goal is to get people actively engaged in politics, not that they know everything about it, but what do they do with their knowledge? And I hope that the same thing was about math. It's how you use it, not knowing it. Knowing it's helpful if you want to use it, but you know, if you can make it a little more exciting, it's a little bit better. And your enthusiasm is really a good testimony to why this kind of teaching is important and why having programs like this allow teachers to get excited again about what they teach. So thanks for being here.
Any other, anything else for these witnesses? Yes.
Is it
Barbara,
my turn?
Go ahead.
Co-chairs and members, I just want to add, I know that your view is not just of policy, but specifically how well our dollars are spent, and that's vital in this endeavor. And I would hope that when you look at the language of this bill, it's all about leveraging those dollars. It's about reaching a handful of teachers. We'd like to reach more. But with those teachers, as Mr. Monarchy described, reaching ultimately thousands of students like these. So you can do the math in whatever way you like. whether it's you look at, you know, how much it is cost per teacher, it's a little over $500 to attend, or it's amount per student. If you conservatively estimate 120 students per teacher in a single year, then it's less than $5 per student. But ultimately, it's about the state and having well-informed citizens. And as these students suggest, they go home and help their parents. And there are those wonderful ripple effects that flow from this, and I hope that you will keep those kinds of things in mind when you consider this bill. Thank you.
And I'm glad that you now know more about government than your parents do.
I agree.
It's not unusual. When I was 12 years old, I waited for the voter's pamphlet, and I read it cover to cover and told my parents how they ought to vote. By the time I was 14, they were actually listening to me. So getting an early start in an interest in government is very important. You might end up sitting here someday.
That's right.
Anything else? Thank you very much. Appreciate all of you coming.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to hear for, is the legislators are here for 2871?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's do that. Let's temporarily close the public hearing on 2955 and open a public hearing on 2871. And it looks like we got four legislators out there. Who wants to come first? Okay. Johnson and Reed and Nierman and
which one is Dembro here?
Senator
for?
Dembro's back there. He's waiting.
He's scheming.
Okay.
Bill.
Yes, Representative Reed, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I'm Tobias Reed from Beaverton. I'm here with two of my colleagues from the House Committee on Higher Education, Innovation, and Workforce Development. And I think I simply want to say that during the course of our work, there were lots of things we didn't quite agree on. We came from different perspectives, but these gentlemen will confirm if they agree. But I think this is the bill we were most excited about our work on, and I hope it gets your approval as well. They and others who might testify on it will probably have lots of other detail to share with you, but we heard really compelling testimony about the impact that textbook affordability has on the experience that students have. The number of students who are not obtaining the course materials that they need and the impact that has on their success, the amount of people who are selecting their classes in part based on the cost of the materials, all of that impact has been significant. And we heard from one of the national leaders on this, a gentleman named Dr. Cable Green. His testimony is in OLIS from our policy hearing, and I commend it to you. It was really excellent and talked about the impact that this approach can have in reducing costs and making course materials much more flexible and relevant for students and for faculty members. The modest investment that this bill proposes would have a big impact. It matters in terms of the experience for students and for the costs that are significant for institutions. It allows for an open education resource specialist that would help universities and faculty members navigate the open education resources that are already out there, because we don't have to create a lot of new things. It's a matter often of navigating and using what's there, and would create grants for the development of new materials with a particular emphasis on high enrollment courses that are part of the Associate of Arts Transfer Module. I do want to mention two things about amendments. Since the bill left our committee and came to you, we became aware of a technical change that is needed, and that's represented by the A3 amendments that have to do with conforming to the Americans with Disabilities Act. So we'd recommend that you adopt the Dash A3 amendments. We're aware of some other amendments that we're not as much a fan of, but the Dash A3s, we'd appreciate your adopting those amendments. I could go on for a long time about this because I'm really passionate about this, and I recognize the people who have done work before me, so I'll turn it over to them. I hope you'll support the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
Representative Reed, we've been just authorized for public hearings so far.
Okay.
I'm sure that we will have a work session, and we'll certainly take into consideration your concerns and your preference for the A3 amendment at that time.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and co-chairs Comp and Monroe. Mark Johnson from House District 52. Just want to second the comments from our committee chair. This really was a good piece of work. I've had the privilege of serving on House Higher Ed for 3 terms now, and each and every term we've heard about the cost of textbooks as being one of the key cost drivers for students and so forth in terms of driving up the cost of their education. You might recall when the students came down for their rally day back in March or April, I forget the day, but they had some asks, and one of them obviously was more money, you know, into the system in general, but specifically asking for open source resources to drive down the cost of their textbooks and so forth. Because I think from our perspective, we try to fight the cost of tuition. There's a couple ways we can do that. We can obviously put another $100 million or $200 million into the kitty, if you will, for higher ed or for community colleges. But direct costs, out-of-pocket costs for students, that whatever we can do to lower that, we should be doing. And there's just unanimity among the Oregon Student Association that this is a great way to go. So I'm excited about the potential for what this can do, because we literally have heard testimony from students who each month or each every have to make the determination, do I buy textbooks or do I buy food? You know, and that's really not the situation we want. So again, we're talking about some basic high capacity courses that should be available without making a student pay $100 or $200 for a textbook. And these need to be transferable across the board. If you get the class at a community college, a university, those courses need to be transferable. So that's really what's in play here. So we've heard it for 3 sessions in a row. Let's do something about it. Finally, let's take some action and make some progress and try to help our students attend college more affordably and get to completion. So thank you very much.
You bet. Representative Nearman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I'll do some bipartisan piling on here. There's a lot of good cost reasons.
Tell us your name.
Oh, yeah. My name is Mike Nierman. I'm the state representative from House District 23. There's a lot of good reasons for cost to do this, and one of the ones that I was impressed with was the relative costs in community colleges for textbooks as opposed to tuition is very high, and so that's a great reason to do this. But my friends talked about costs. So I want to switch to a different topic. I'm a software engineer, and that's kind of where the open source really shines, and that's what we're talking about is kind of open source textbooks. And in the software world, it drives down costs, but it also adds flexibility and adaptability to the systems. Mm-hmm. I'll quote one of my heroes. He's a guy named Linus Torvalds. He invented the Linux operating system, which is named after him, and he had a quote that says that with open source, all bugs are shallow. And the idea of that is that if there's problems, there's an entire community set up to address those. And so and I think the same thing can happen in higher education, where rather than, oh, now we have to go to the 15th edition of Chemistry 101 or something like that, and it'll be 2.5 years before that comes out. Adapting to the needs of students or adapting to changes in the educational landscape can be done quickly. So I look forward to this. And like my colleagues, this gets the gold star as the most exciting bill of the committee for this thing. I wouldn't even say of the committee. I would just say of the session for me personally. Thanks.
Thank you. Questions for the representatives?
Mr. Chair, there's one element I forgot to mention, which would just take 10 seconds. Another piece in the bill is the requirement that institutions make it plain to students which courses have open education resources as part of the course so that students can choose, at least in part, based on that.
Senator Roblin.
So I have a couple questions, if I may. I think OpenCES has real advantages in a whole lot of ways. I also worry that it is a self-regulating, that people add value to it out there because that's what they want to do. So these textbooks, are we buying from the person who wrote the textbooks? Are we paying them the same way they would get paid as other issues with regard to their, quote, copyrighted material? Or do they continue to make money? I have a daughter who's a playwright, and wondering how people's intellectual property is moved around in these places. I just want to make sure that that's covered pretty well in this bill. And a second one is we've got the Gates Foundation doing a lot of this work. They say it's about $1 million a book, if I look at their stuff, to put them into place and to get it all done. We have $800,000 or whatever in the bill. Is that enough to do a book or two? And if we're only doing one or two books, yes, it saves some money, but would that money have been better spent, you know, $1.1 million in supporting people who need to buy textbooks as opposed to doing the other? That's kind of where I'm trying to figure out how all this works.
I'll just jump in here and start. Thanks for the question, Senator Roblin. There actually is some real good work underway already. OSU has been working on this in a lab that they have at their campus to provide resources there. So we're not starting from scratch. We're kind of building on what they already are doing, but trying to replicate that and push it out to the other institutions. But what's in view here is a peer-reviewed process, ample opportunity for these professors to come together and talk about what are those resources, what can we agree on, and so forth. But regarding the cost, I think it's totally feasible to think that we could have 30. The bill calls for at least 30 different courses should be able to have open source resources with the investment we're talking about by 2017, I believe, right?
Yes, June 30, 2017.
So I don't think the cost that you're outlining is as prohibitive as what we were told in committee. So it's well underway, and there are efforts to build on it, what work that's already been done.
Exactly. Mr. Chair, Senator Roman, just to pick up on that last point, I think that $1 million price is probably, I think it's high, but it's especially high. If it's the only place it may be relevant is where there is nothing already existing.
Right.
So being the fast follower in this case, we can build on a lot of things that are already there. And so the work for Oregon may be minimal in terms of adapting and melding pieces that already exist. And part of the requirement would be that the payment goes to the people who create that through the grant. And so the content is then openly licensed. And that, of course, means that it's available to others to mix and repurpose and adapt so long as it continues to be publicly available. So I think the costs will come down considerably for us. And as Representative Johnson said, the bill, we've spent a lot of time with Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and they believe they'll have no trouble meeting 30 classes by June 30th, 2017.
Okay. Anything additional? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure to have you before our little subcommittee here. And Senator Dembro, did you want to jump in here?
No, it's fine. They were great.
Okay. So now we go.
Going down the line.
Ken Brown from PCC. And
hello.
Dave Resenfeld from Augsburg. Let's start with those two, and then we'll take the rest of them.
Good morning. And it is morning. It's not afternoon. It's hard to follow the young people. I have to extend my appreciation to them because my daughter was down here last year testifying on a Coltrane issue that her class had studied, and they testified, and I just always appreciate that. But co-chairs Monroe and Comp, members of the committee, I'm actually here not entirely in my capacity as a district manager at Portland Community College, but as a representative.
Co-chair, yeah, we need his name for the record.
Oh, it's Ken Brown. Sorry. I'm here as a representative of the National Association of College Stores and PCC. I'm a member of the Open Educational Resources Steering Committee at Portland Community College. A little bit of my background, Dave and I were catching up. We've been working on textbook affordability issues for over 10 years. I was at Portland State University as the president and CEO of the bookstore there. And I worked with former Congressman Wu and helped inform his process in adding textbook affordability language to the Higher Education Opportunity Act. I'm also one of the co-authors of the 2012 report that was done under the auspices of HECC, although there was actually no standing committee at that time. But today I want to just recommend three amendments to HB 2871. It sounds like the House has adopted some or is recommending some language on accessibility. I highly recommend that. As part of my written testimony that I submitted at the end of last week, the Disability Services Director at Portland Community College and her colleague at Oregon State University sent me some information about current cases that are pending, that have been filed around accessibility issues, many of which involve course materials. So I highly, highly recommend that anything using taxpayer dollars to develop course materials proactively have language in there to address accessibility. It's just a prudent thing to do from a legal perspective, and it's also the right thing to do to provide equal access to those of our students statewide that have other challenges that we oftentimes currently do not meet. And I think those cases are going to be coming up more and more under Title VII, Title IX, and ADA. So I highly, highly recommend adding language. And the language that I've included in here is actually from the state of California's bill as a model. They were since they have been one of the hotbeds for the legal cases, they did include it in their open educational resources bill. The other two measures reflect the role that college stores play in the dissemination of information. Part of this bill requires identifying courses with that use open educational resources, and currently the only way to do that in a timely manner in a quarterly system is through the bookstores. So that language is very important to recognize that to foster the collaboration with anyone developing open educational resources under these grants, that they look at ways at how they're going to be disseminated, how that information is going to be provided. I know one of the concerns that our OER steering committee has is how we're going to gather and communicate information to students, both and if it gets out of control where it's only on syllabi, then the other services on campuses, such as disability services, that rely on the information to prepare for their students, they won't know, and they don't have access to those syllabi frequently. In general, I'm not going to read them, but we're looking at collaboration. We have the platforms, we have the technology, we have the expertise, we have the standing on our campuses to communicate the information. And these are two very simple amendments that would further those causes.
Thank you.
And I'm more than open to any questions. I've been on this issue a long time.
Questions of anybody? Senator Roblin?
So there's, because of Gates and Hewlett, there's a bunch of organizations out there
that have
been helping make this happen. So they've got OpenStax. And do we, are we encouraging professors to choose from that list so that, I mean, part of the issue is professors have their own choices of the kind of materials they want to use in their classroom. Are we having a real conversation about what's out there right now so that they can choose from that, so that it's already been produced, as opposed to us having a source to do that with? And then secondarily, once they've picked it, the question, I appreciate your amendments, because the syllabus, they don't use the whole book a lot of times. They use portions. Right. And so how do the students know where to go, how to get it, and so on? And who's supporting the access to these materials, if you know any of that?
Right now, OpenStax in particular, like I'm opening negotiations with OpenStax right now I have access to that entire list if any of our faculty choose them under academic freedom, which is what you're referring to. And I'm in a negotiation with them, or opening negotiations with them as of last week, to provide print copies as necessary as well, because our students are still heavily print-oriented. What they actually want is digital access and print combined, and that addresses various types of accessibility. OpenStax, in particular, under accessibility issues, they are still struggling with making their materials fully accessible under the current standards, and they're very sensitive to that. I met with them in February. They have a very strong list. They're developing more. I will tell you, part of the discussion that is out there right now is that when their grant funding expires, how do they continue? And they are looking at financializing their model. And what they don't want to do is become publishers. That seems somewhat antithetical, and that's what they are, in fact, becoming. So there's some, I would characterize it as there's tension within this issue. OER has tremendous possibility in many disciplines, and in others, it's going to be challenging.
Thank you.
Okay. Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. You talk about the extensive list of materials that are available. Are those, do you send those out to all the professors, or how would a professor, how does the faculty get to know what's available?
We don't. The College Store's role is as the aggregator of the information and the procurer of the books for resale to the student, or to provide the information to the student. It's incumbent upon the faculty, now coming from a university, it's stronger where the individual faculty member makes the decision. At the community college level, we have subject area committees at PCC that review and select the materials that are to be used for delivery of the classes. And we use a lot of adjunct faculty, a lot of part-time faculty, and they are effectively plug and play. They want these subject area committees want materials to deliver consistent educational experiences to our students, and then the faculty are assigned to those materials in many disciplines. Not all disciplines, but many disciplines. So it is incumbent upon the faculty and or faculty groups to make the decision as to what materials are being used and to communicate that to us because we're the primary interface with the student.
Okay.
I think so. The questions I have are at a different, go to a different direction.
Okay. Mr. Rosenfeld.
Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dave Rosenfeld, executive director of OSPIRG, the consumer group. By way of background, before I joined OSPIRG in 2008, for about 10 or 15 years, I coordinated the programming for the student public interest research groups nationally, and spent a lot of time also working in California with the University of California campuses. And I was, in that time, starting in 2001, I led the original research effort that quantified what the problem was with college textbooks, why they were a problem, and how we're going to solve it. So I spent a good 10 years on that, and that really proud of how that's just blew up into a big national conversation and just sparked an enormous amount of activity in states and colleges and also in Congress. Unfortunately, it's still a big problem, and I won't spend a lot of time on that because you're well aware of the cost of textbooks and all of that. Instead, I'd like to get to basically some of the questions that are here and why we think this is a perfectly good investment and some of the caveats that you ought to be aware of with the investment that you're making as well and what to look for in 2017 if this goes through. So first, I think it's really good to understand why this is such a difficult problem to solve. First is that the textbook market is a monopoly market. It's just a handful of publishers control about 90% of the thing, and it's a tough market to crack into just because it's very infrastructure heavy. Second is that this market is kind of like healthcare, which is that the person that orders the product isn't the person that pays for the product. In this case, we're talking about the professor, not the doctor, and so it's basically a broken market. Supply and demand don't work the way that it ordinarily does. And so as a result, you have this what economists call price inelasticity. And as a result, textbook publishers, they don't have any incentive to respond to the market because they can just keep doing what they're doing. And so we put out, that's why we see new editions of calculus, you know, every year or two, even though calculus hasn't really changed since the times of Isaac Newton, which is not my words. It's the words of a UC Berkeley math professor who knows a thing or two about calculus. I would presume that I don't know as much as her about that. So that's kind of the problem. And then you have academic freedom. And nobody, we would not be ever the ones that would say that faculty shouldn't be the ones in charge of choosing course materials. They should. So we don't want to go down that road. We never would. And the other kind of road you could go down if you're trying to solve the problem, price control, probably has too many negative consequences to even be worth considering. So then what are you left with? You're not left with a lot. And clearly, it has to be a market-based kind of solution. There are things that are out there already, rental programs and used books and these e-books and that kind of thing. But all of them basically suffer from the same problem, which is just they're tethered to the price of the new textbook and the publishing industry's ability to just keep churning out new editions and that kind of thing. So we, quite a while ago, we saw the open textbook thing emerging. And I think we're convinced that of all the solutions that are out there, this is probably the one that has the most promise. So I guess we'll just start with that. We did a part of what's in the written testimony on OLIS We did a Student Perks did a report a couple of months ago that took a look at about five college-based open textbook programs that have similarities to what OSU has set up. OSU wasn't studied, and takes a look at just how are they working. And all of them invest money in some way, shape, or form. That's probably the one thing that they have in common is there's some investment of money. And all of them have seen savings, savings that in the aggregate outstrip the amount of money that's going into it. The average savings in those programs is about $120 a student. We basically figured out that, you know, I mean, take this for what it is, because there's not a lot of data, but if you basically were swapped for every student that's in this country and you swapped one of their introductory textbooks with an open textbook, that would aggregate to about $1 billion in savings. I mean, that's like almost like a financial aid program when you look at that nationally. So there's a savings to be had when you do it. Now, the question is, when we say do it, what does that mean? What's the reason why more faculty aren't adopting open textbooks? And there are reasons for that. One is just awareness. That's definitely an issue. We've done both formal and informal surveys, and you know, change is hard, and change is, sometimes you're just not aware of that. So that's one thing. Second is just accessibility. And what I mean by that is, I mean, obviously anyone can get on the internet and figure this out, but if you've been teaching for 20 years, you're used to one way of doing things, and curating open textbooks isn't as plug and play. I mean, the analogy I think of is like, you know, you can hire someone to, you know, do your plumbing in your house and it's more expensive, but you know that it's all done, or you can take the time to go figure out how to do plumbing and, you know, it'll be cheaper, but you got to take some time to figure out how to, you know, do all that and wrap plumbing tape, and you might not do as good of a job. And so what we find is that faculty need a little bit of, and so that's one problem if you've been around a while. And then the other problem is obviously the more that we're using adjunct professors and, you know, teaching staff that don't have a lot of time and have increasing workloads, then the transition from going from the current thing to the new thing is a little bit harder. And so there needs to be a little bit more assistance. That's what we mean by access. And then the final thing is like this availability quality thing. We've talked to a lot of faculty that have tried open textbooks and just don't feel like it's up to the standard that they want. And so even though they're very sympathetic to the students' concerns, they feel like they have, rightfully so, an obligation to provide the best instructional material. So in some instances, that's a problem as well. So then what this does, the reason why the bill is a good idea is that well, first off, as has been referenced, there are a bunch of schools, OSU, Lane, that are already trying to do some stuff at the campus level to just make resources available to faculty and give them some training and handholding and whatnot. It would be good to make sure that all the schools can take advantage of that and make the whole greater than the sum of its parts. So by having somebody dedicated at HEC to be able to just do that, it would be interesting to see if there's value in that. That's like, I think, $100,000 of the allocation. And then the competitive grants program, you know, I think most of the conversation thus far has been about giving grants to faculty or people to write books, and that would certainly be part of it. But frankly, just giving grants to schools to be able to do trainings for faculty on how to do all of this stuff. We've seen at other schools around the country that actually sometimes gets you more value. So just to give you another way with which the money might be spent that could end up being quite valuable in helping faculty make the transition into the new world and get more of these books online. So that's the 2 cents on that. And then I'll just say, I don't have any reason to think that HEC wouldn't do this, but I think one thing that we'll be committed to doing if this ends up passing is I think you want to make sure that there's some really good tracking metrics in place so that by the time the report back comes, you have a lot more data about how well this worked and in what way. So just to give you 2 examples. You definitely want to track textbook adoptions, and you want to track it down to the book level. And what you want to be able to do is also track retention. So what we've seen, this dynamic I was talking about before, where a faculty member will give it a try and then just feel like something about it wasn't quite right. You want to be able to see, as a result of this grant or that grant, did it result in more adoptions, and did those adoptions stick in some way, shape, or form? So you can really take a look at the savings. And so I think you'll want to make sure that some metrics are worked out, you know, up front, and that are baked into any of the spending that goes on, so that you have some really good data to say in 2017, okay, how well did this work and what should we do moving forward?
Senator Roblin.
So, and I think you're probably the person to talk to because you've been in this so long. What about the technical support for kids getting on and access, website failure, 24-hour service, I'm on my text, I want something to happen, all of a sudden it goes away, and what do I do?
I mean, open source gets better all the time. I agree with that and its structure, but those are issues. Is HEC going to kind of try to take responsibility or watch that to find out where the best books with the greatest online failure rate or least failure rate, all those kinds of things, because it is still a technologically based system that from time to time makes people very frustrated because they can't get engaged in it. Was there any history with that, with the work you've done?
Yeah. Co-chairs, members, and Senator Rublin. Yes, and so I guess just two responses. One point of clarification is we use the word open textbooks as distinct from open source.
Right.
Because one thing we have found, at least for now, maybe in 20 years this will be different, is that there's a the type of content we're talking about in open textbook, there's something kind of almost closed about it, as it were. In other words, you're not going on to some like strange Wikipedia type thing where it seems like everybody's editing things a mile a minute. You're talking about a body of work that's been done that might have some interactivity to it, but that the faculty member can control the licensing, including just how much it can get mixed and matched. And so a lot of times you're just talking about a PDF more than anything else.
Okay. A download.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes it easier.
So, and I think that's mostly when I'm talking about open textbooks, that's mostly what I'm talking about, because that's mostly what we're seeing. And then the interactive features are fairly light. It would be the equivalent, I suppose, of going on to the New York Times website, and mostly it's just content as you would imagine it, and then every once in a while a cool little map that you can click and whatever. And then the print-on-demand feature, of course, really, really matters. So for the time being, the surveys that we've done of students, and I think this would be another metric you'd want to be doing, is surveying students who are using this just to get more of a real-life feedback. We find that there isn't really that much of an issue, just because it feels like the most basic internet-y kind of thing you've got out there, which is a PDF.
Cool. And these files aren't so large that they're creating a problem with access with respect to kids and the kind of where they're putting those PDF files.
Yeah. Is that Co-chair true? Senator Rublin, not that I know of. Okay. That doesn't mean that that's not a problem.
Well, if they have a lot of pictures and other kinds of stuff on them, that could be an issue.
Yeah. They certainly can be.
Okay.
Co-chairs Senator Rublin, but this is one of the things that there needs to be a little bit of interventions going on. It's not just a plug and play kind of thing.
Okay.
And faculty members will need to kind of be shown, okay, here's the right kind of file you want to get and all that kind of stuff. And
okay, thanks.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. Appreciate
your
testimony. Let's have Dana Richardson and Diana Fisher. Okay, Fisher, you're first.
Go ahead. Okay. Thank you, Co-Chair Comp and Co-Chair Monroe and members of the committee. My name is Diana Fisher. I am the Director of Open Oregon State at OSU. And I'd like to follow up on a couple of the things that were said by everyone previous to me. First of all, we fully support the A3 amendments. For the last 15 years, I worked as the Director of Course Development and Training at OSU, and OSU has over 40 online degree programs that are fully online. And we make everything we can accessible as we build. So we are completely in support of the A3 amendments for accessibility for anything that we do online. Secondly, it was mentioned about the bookstore and how to get things posted in an expedient manner. And I've had meetings with our bookstore, and our bookstore has agreed to post anything that is available openly and free in the course catalog. I'm not sure if you are familiar at all with how the OSU bookstore lists its books and other course materials for students, but they also give students a choice in their materials. So if a faculty member assigns a textbook and the bookstore sells it, when the student goes on to the bookstore site to look at the book, they are given a choice to pay the price of the OSU bookstore, and then it also lists Amazon, half.com, any other place online that also sells that textbook. So the student has a choice on the price that they pay. The OSU bookstore is not always the least expensive place to buy the book, so they give the students an option. Also, our online course catalog, we tried it this summer. We had 8 courses this summer who were using open materials through a grant program that we used. And in the course catalog, immediately we could post that those sections of the course were using open and no-cost materials for students. So I think that's what I wanted to follow up on with things that others had said. I did bring a book if anyone wanted to look at this book. I can pass it if anyone wants to look. So I had a graduate course this fall term, and it was an introduction to statistics, but it was at the graduate level. The textbook from the publisher was $275, but the instructor gave us a choice to use an open textbook. So I had this textbook printed for me from Amazon, and my total price, including shipping, was only $9. That replaced a $275 textbook. This is listed on the website for the American Institute for Mathematics as an approved open textbook. So they have already looked at the quality and said that it was quality. I'll just pass it if it... So a $9, including shipping, textbook replaced a $275 textbook. The number of students that were in that class were over 400 students. I also wanted to tell you about a business professor who came to me just last week. When he assigned his final exam information to the students, and this was a lower division business class with about 100 students, he told them that they could bring the textbooks in to the class because they would have an open exam, so they were allowed to use their textbooks. He said by the time class ended and immediately afterwards, he was getting emails from about half the students in the class who told them that he hadn't bought the textbook. The textbook was too expensive, so they wanted to know if he had a copy of the textbook that they could borrow in order to do the open text exam. So he went through the building and asked all the other professors if they had previous versions of the textbook that he could borrow to get to the students so that they could take their final exam, because as he told me and told them, the textbook hadn't changed in the last 5 versions. So he collected all those so that the students had enough textbooks to use for their open exams. So Open Oregon State is working with faculty and collaborating with the community colleges and the other 4-year universities to bring open textbooks to the students. We do have a grant program right now because Oregon State is the land grant institution in the state. We were given some money from outreach and engagement to try to get faculty involved in this. So we were able to give them some small grants. And that enabled them to start writing some textbooks in collaboration with faculty from the community colleges and the other 4 years. And some of the I know what we hear against some of the open textbooks is how does the quality compare? Well, we have our faculty in collaboration with faculty at other community colleges working on some of these. And because we're lucky and we have the Oregon State University Press, we can take advantage of peer review. We can take advantage of the press's editors. And so not only are we creating open textbooks for the students, but the faculties are also getting a real publication published by a university press. We're also members of several collaboratives, one being the Open Textbook Library, which is in collaboration with Ohio State and Arizona State, Purdue, Minnesota, Michigan, several others where we work together to provide open textbooks. So we are addressing the quality and the peer review. And we do provide the training for faculty. We have a training coming up later this summer, and we have invited anyone from the other 4 years and the community colleges to attend. So I think that's all that I wanted to say. I'm happy to answer some questions about anything that we're currently doing.
Thank you very much. Dana?
Co-Chairs Comp and Monroe, for the record, Dana Richardson, Deputy Director for Legislative and Policy Affairs at the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I wanted to note for you that in 2012, one of the first things you ever asked the HEC to do was look at textbook affordability. There was, I think, one FTE at that point. So we undertook that work. I've submitted just a brief summary of what we accomplished. It included a national literature review, a review of current activities. As you've heard, there's quite a lot of activity to build on, I think, and that's what this investment will go toward. We did a student textbook affordability survey, as well as held regional forums. So the open education resources are really, as you've heard, kind of a part of a menu of approaches to textbook affordability. We have campuses that are currently doing textbook checkout programs, textbook exchanges, and of course the open education resources. So I just wanted to highlight a couple of the strengths and weaknesses that our commission identified in this study. Certainly some of the strengths to OERs are the low cost to students and the customization by faculty. Some of the challenges can be availability, high-speed internet, as Senator Roblin has alluded to, the investment of faculty time that's needed to really develop comfort in using it in their coursework, and then having alternative formats available for students with disabilities. So I'm happy to note that the bill before you contains most of the best practices that we identified, which include allowing for a quality peer review, allowing for cross-institutional faculty engagement, building on the work that OSU and others have been involved in, focusing on some of the highly used courses, those that are in the Oregon Transfer module. You'll note that's a focus of the bill as well. Ensuring that the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, is complied with, and then trying to address the technology barriers. So I just wanted to highlight for you those components of the bill, and certainly that you've asked our commission to look at this, and certainly we'd be part of the implementation. Happy to take any questions.
Thanks, Dana. Questions for Dana? Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. That just made me think, Dana, can you give me an example of textbooks now and how they are adapted for students with disabilities, like a regular textbook, and the difference in what the open online
Ms. Fisher may be a better resource, but certainly you've got sight impaired folks. There are larger texts. There are obviously by touch Braille adaptations that, in order to comply, there are opportunities to have readers. So if you're if you're an oral, then you can. There's technology that will read a book for you, that sort of thing. And you may be aware of other more up-to-date examples, but
that's true. And the students with student accessibility office on campus offers all of those services. The first thing that we try to do when we're building materials, especially if they're going into an online course, is we make sure that they are as accessible as we can possibly do in our office. And then we go to the student access office, and they can help out. They can do everything from reading to providing closed captioning on videos, doing descriptions of images, all of that sort of thing.
So may I follow up briefly?
Yes.
So it sounds like the assumption is that regular textbooks already have these kind of built in, and we need to make built. I mean, it sounds. But on the other hand, it sounds like it's probably an issue regardless of whether you're using a standard textbook or these new technologies, that you would go through the same process and follow the same kind of making sure that there's coverage. It's not that traditional textbooks already have that built in. It's that you'd have to do the same for these new open sources that we already do for the...
Co-chairs, Dr. Smith-Warner, yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, ladies. We appreciate your testimony. Was there anybody else that wanted to be heard on 2871? Close a public hearing on 2871 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 78.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 78 comes to you from the Senate Committee on Education. The bill requires the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission to establish standards related to a teacher education program to be accredited by a national organization, as well as adopt standards related to the approval of a public teacher education program of more than 4 years' duration. The bill has a $283,643 total funds impact with one position at 0.5 FTE, and the fiscal impact statement was just posted this morning. It is under meeting materials for today's date in the subcommittee.
Okay. And we have Mary Cadiz from Chalkboard. And Randy Hitz from Portland State.
Good
Good morning.
Good morning. Co-chairs Comp and Monroe and members of the committee. I'm Mary Cattis. I direct the Teach Oregon Project. It's a chalkboard initiative working with school districts and university teacher preparation programs. And we're working to establish a collaborative effort to improve teacher preparation in Oregon. Three of these projects are funded by chalkboard, but just a reminder that two are funded through the Network of Quality Teaching and Learning. We have 13 school districts that we're working with, soon to add a couple more, seven universities and four community colleges, and we are completing our second year of implementation. I'm here today to provide you with information regarding Senate Bill 78A, and I'm joined by Dr. Randy Hitz, Dean of the Graduate School of Education at Portland State. Dean Hitz serves on the Executive Board for CAPE, on the National Data Task Force, and chairs the Continuous Improvement Commission for CAPE. And just some information for you, Portland State's Graduate School of Education faculty and Dean Hitz will be the first Oregon Teacher Preparation Program to seek accreditation under the new professional standards this fall. Dean Hitz.
Dean Hitz, welcome.
Yeah, thank you. Co-chairs Comp and Monroe, members of the committee, I'm pleased to be here to support Senate Bill 78A, and I thank you for this opportunity.
You have to give us your name.
Oh, sorry. For the record, I'm Randy Hitz, Dean of the Graduate School of Education at Portland State.
Thank you.
Sorry. So Mary gave you some of my background. I won't reiterate that. I should also say, though, that Oregon has had a very good and close relationship with our national accrediting body. We're actually one of the first states to be involved in a project to improve the clinical experience, and I just want to call out Vicki Chamberlain and Keith Mink of TSPC, who have been really good leaders in that, and also Mary Cattis, who is part of that effort for the state of Oregon. I also want to acknowledge that the Oregon Legislature has taken some really good leadership in creating the Network for Quality Teaching and Learning, and that is relevant to this particular bill, and I thank you for that leadership. One of the more recent developments that's happened that's nationally that's relevant to this is in 2013, there were two accrediting bodies in the nation, two national accrediting bodies, and they merged into one. And that one is now the Council for the Accreditation of Educator Preparation, call it CAPE, that's the acronym. And what that means is that the teaching profession is now speaking with one voice with regard to standards and what those means, what that means. And that's what mature professions do. In mature professions, engineering, medicine, architecture, so on, pharmacy, they have a single accrediting body, one voice, and they expect everybody to meet those standards. And you can imagine, you can't imagine, I suppose, that you would go to a physician who didn't graduate from an accredited program, right? Well, in education today, there's only about 65% of the teacher education programs in the nation, and fewer in Oregon, fewer percentage in Oregon, are actually nationally accredited. So we need to advance the profession by making sure that every educator comes from a nationally accredited program, and that's what this bill is really all about. It's about advancing the profession, and that's what makes it consistent with your efforts through the National Network for the Network for Quality Teaching and Learning. So I understand why some universities might have been reluctant to pursue national accreditation. There is some cost involved, and Mary will talk about that in a little bit more detail. I don't think it's exorbitant, but it is going to be very helpful, I think, if the legislature can provide some incentive support for some universities to obtain national accreditation. So I thank you for your time and be happy to answer questions.
Thank you very much. Mary?
Okay. Co-chairs and members of the committee, research is clear that the single most important factor, and I know many of you are aware of this, is in improving our student achievement is an effective teacher. And our teacher preparation programs in Oregon play a huge role in making this happen along with our school districts. The 2013 audit by the Secretary of State, now Governor, Kate Brown's office, revealed that half of the school district administrators responding to that audit survey indicated that our teacher preparation programs did not sufficiently prepare our teachers. So we move to national accreditation. What will that do? It will raise the bar on the review process for teacher preparation programs through the use of a more rigorous national standard. It will bring in external site reviewers. It will require closer partnerships and stronger clinical experiences between universities and school districts in preparing our teachers. It will require the use of outcome evidence-based measures to inform continuous improvement, and it will demand continuous self-assessment of these programs. Evidence would need to be used to support the program's claim of meeting the standards. It also focuses on active recruitment of highly qualified and diverse teacher candidates. It would also prepare our teacher preparation programs for the requirements that we're anticipating under the reauthorization of the Higher Education Act, which as proposed would tie directly to the use of TEACH grant funds for Oregon students preparing to become teachers. It also emphasizes the fact that programs should be judged by outcomes and impacts. Effort is not enough. Currently, only 8 of our 17 TSPC-approved teacher preparation programs in Oregon have national accreditation. Senate Bill 78A creates a 7-year runway for our teacher preparation programs in Oregon to become nationally accredited. They would need to become accredited under these new standards by 2022. The bill also includes the creation of a fund, both for FTE and for monies to assist programs in preparing to meet these higher standards. We need to ask ourselves, with the continuing rise in the cost of our university programs, should there not be a level of quality assurance with our teacher preparation programs for students and their parents? Shouldn't all of our teacher preparation programs be able to advertise this quality seal of excellence that many of our programs can? Our smaller preparation programs produce many high-quality teachers here in Oregon, and yet many lack the resources to go through the process of accreditation. Senate Bill 78A would give them a start. The resources requested in this bill would provide every Oregon teacher preparation program access to funds to pay for their CAPE fees. We hear vastly different numbers when it comes to the cost of accreditation. If we count every minute of staff's preparation as a cost, we can come up with a figure that's quite high. The truth is that putting programs to the rigorous test of higher standards, increased evidence, and external review should be part of the way that high-quality teacher preparation programs do business, and the way they provide students and parents with the assurance that the program is meeting these higher standards. This is just sound professional practice. Costs for accreditation can include surveys, data gathering, data software, management, collaborative time for faculty and staff to meet together to examine their practice and the evidence around that practice. Some might question the use of these funds for private teacher preparation programs. Our reality in Oregon is that we have about half of our teachers prepared by private and independent colleges and universities. Mm-hmm. These programs are often more flexible and able to attract culturally diverse and non-traditional students into the teacher workforce. This also is an important goal for Oregon in meeting our target under the Educator Equity Act, and that was formerly the Minority Teacher Act, which under House Bill 3375A became the Educator Equity Act in Oregon. Thank you for this opportunity. We urge your support of 78A, and we're happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you very much. When I was a decade on the board of Mount Hood Community College and then a decade on the board of David Douglas, I remember at David Douglas in particular when I was chair, they would hire teacher candidates from Warner Pacific College almost without even checking them out, because they knew that Warner Pacific had a reputation for doing such a wonderful job. And that's a private institution. I got my teaching degree from Portland State and went on to a lengthy career. But I appreciate what you said about the importance of some of the private universities and colleges. Because sometimes their programs may be even superior to Portland State, although that's hard to believe.
Case in point, sir.
Anyway, thank you for coming.
Are there questions?
Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair, just an appreciation of the work that's being done. This is an area that, as a school principal, I too looked at lots of applications and saw a lot of beginning teachers, and to have the national accreditation is a huge step, and I know you've been working incredibly hard. So just my appreciation, and thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Is there anybody else that wanted to be heard on Senate Bill 78? Not, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 78. And was there anybody that didn't get to testify on 2955 that wanted to testify on 2955? Okay, we won't reopen that then. Krista, anything else?
That's it for today. You guys have a full agenda for the week. The one change that is changed since we last met is that on Thursday you're going to be doing probably a bunch more work sessions on some of these policy bills, and probably will not be hearing the ODE budget on that day.
Okay. But we're still hearing HEC tomorrow?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Still we'll see y'all tomorrow.
So what's happening?